take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Ezra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ezra.
Hello, I'm Ezra Klein. Welcome to The Ezra Klein Show. So before we get to the conversation today, and God, what a pleasure today's conversation is, a very quick announcement. We are hiring for an associate producer for the show. And I always like to announce this on the podcast itself, because I always hope we'll get somebody from inside the show's universe, somebody who knows what we're about and loves the show and wants to be part of it. But this is a position that's going to be involved in cutting tape on these episodes. It's going to be a position involved in researching and booking guests and putting up transcripts. It's a little bit jack of all trades. You can find the listing in the description for this episode, the show notes. You can also find it if you go to nytco.com and go to their careers page. But check it out. You do need 2 years audio experience to apply. Don't apply if you don't have that, because your application won't be looked at. But if you do have it, go take a look if this is a job of interest to you. So this conversation with George Saunders is long in the making. I saw George Saunders speak when I was in college, and it never left me. There was such brilliance and such a deep humanity and kindness. It just, everything he said, it just infused the way he thought extemporaneously on his feet. It made this very long-standing impression on me, and I've wanted to talk to him ever since. He is obviously written a slew of amazing books since then. The Brain Dead Megaphone is a book of his nonfiction essays, came out long ago, but it has changed how I think about media to this very day. He's obviously written so many super powerful and influential short stories. Lincoln in the Bardo, his novel, is just a remarkable piece of work. One of the things I always think about with Saunders is this old Abraham Joshua Heschel quote, which is, when I was young, I admired clever people. Now that I'm old, I admire kind people. And for a long time, I had this quote wrong in my head. I thought it was, when I was young, I admired clever people. Now that I'm old, I admire wise people. And I always thought about it with people in DC, which is full of clever people, and wise people, I think, are in shorter supply. But the thing about Saunders' work to me is always that they're is a kindness and a wisdom to it. It is very centrally concerned with this question of, how are we kind to each other in a world that does not always create space for that? How do we take each other's perspective when that is often the hardest possible thing to do? How do we approach things with the qualities and the intentions and the processes and the mental states that will produce some level of wisdom? His new book, A Swim in the Pond in the Rain, is about 7 short stories by Russian masters and about what he took from them and how the stories work on a basic level, but then also what kinds of habits of mind they reflect. And through that, what kinds of habits of mind fiction broadly, literature broadly reflects and cultivates. So it's very much centrally concerned with what I understand to be the main preoccupation of his work, which is how to live well and decently among each other in fellowship. And that's what this conversation is about, too. And it was a total pleasure to get to have it with him. As always, my email is EzraKleinShow@nytimes.com. You can email me your guest suggestions, your feedback, whatever. Here's George Saunders. Let me just begin with the basic human question. How are you?
I'm okay. You know, I'm kind of, we're up in Oneonta, New York, kind of super isolated. And so I'm just kind of using it as an excuse to do what I like to do, which is just work all day. And so, yeah, it's a crazy, sad time, but I guess I just feel like part of the job is to try to keep yourself as mentally healthy and happy as you can. And then, you know, hopefully come out on the other end. How are you doing?
Day by day.
Yeah.
I remember asking somebody on the show, actually, Jenny Odell, who's a great artist. I remember asking her and she told me day by day. And then I said, well, how's today? And she said, it's too early to tell, yeah. Which I've always liked as a way of thinking about this era.
Yeah. I keep thinking that maybe part of the job is to not be any more miserable than you actually are. You know, so if you wake up and you're feeling pretty good, just, you know, go with it.
I think that's actually an important and difficult point right now. On the days I feel bad for feeling bad because my situation is objectively fine. I'm healthy and have not lost my job. And same is true for my family at this point. And then on the days I feel good, I feel bad for feeling good. There's a great piece by a former colleague of mine at Vox about the second arrow of suffering, which I guess is a Buddhist idea that it's important to be present in other people's suffering. But if you just add more suffering in yourself, you're just adding to the total amount of suffering and it doesn't help anybody, which I've tried to hold to. But the meta judgment of how you're feeling day in and day out can be a little tough.
Yeah, which is something you wouldn't normally feel in a normal day. You'd just be kind of going along. But, you know, I was reading Nadezhda Mandelstam, Hope Against Hope. It's this beautiful memoir about the Stalinist time. And that's a pretty good thing to do because, yeah, you know, shit sometimes goes crazy and we're in a version of that now. But it also, you know, makes you think, wow, it could definitely be worse. It's kind of a good little proportion reestablisher.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. So I want to begin here with a quote of yours that I love. Kindness is the only non-delusional response to the human condition. Tell me why.
Well, I think basically, if we look at ourselves, we're kind of set up to be these little Darwinian survivors. So we're given this really cool sensory apparatus and a brain and everything. And, you know, that stuff is there to help us propagate the species. And the, you know, the intersection between our perceptions and understanding and what's actually true are pretty small and pretty occasional, you know, that there's a whole bunch of stuff out there that is beyond our grasp. So if you have any sense of that, then a kind of ritual humility would be the right stance. I mean, imagine if somebody saw in all the wrong colors and all the shapes that he saw were incorrect and all of his understandings were messed up. You know, that person would be wise to be a little humble because the data is coming in, he's messing it up. And essentially, I think that's what human beings are doing in our little sweet, pathetic way. So then if you are in that, you know, kind of flawed thinking machine and you see another flawed thinking machine, it would seem almost crazy and irrational to start judging and fighting that person. You might more reasonably say, oh, wow, you too, you know. So I think in a lot of these Eastern systems, the delusion is that, you know, we're trapped inside this little machine that thinks it's central and permanent and all important and is always thinking it's about its little victory narrative. But when you step out of it for a second, you see that it's just a temporary construction of neurology or karma or whatever. And so it's almost like, you know, if you're driving a really crappy car, you would want to keep that in mind in traffic, you know, something like that.
Kindness is such an important word in your work. I've come across it so much in the prep for this conversation. Just how do you define it? What is kindness to you?
I think ultimately it would be, are you benefiting the people in proximity to you? I mean, and truly benefiting them. And that in itself is a, you know, how would you know?
Yeah, how would you know is I think often a harder problem that we give it credit for.
Yeah.
Why in proximity?
Well, I think that's the place to start. And since I've never been able to even do that, I'm going to continue to work on that one. But certainly, yeah, I mean, to be beneficial in the larger sense. But from my pay grade, that's an occupational hazard because if as a quasi-public person or, you know, if a writer can be considered that, there are bouts of grandiosity where, you know, you do a reading and you talk to people and then you think, oh, yes, I'm benefiting the world. And I think that's kind of a dangerous thing if you're somebody like me, you know, somebody who's my level of understanding and capability. So, yeah, I think really, I mean, literally, you know, if you're there's one person near you, are you doing no harm? Are you in the mental state where any interaction with that person would be neutral or beneficial? Now that sounds so incredibly modest, but that's basically my deal, and I'm failing at it all the time.
I think that focus on the mental state, which we're going to get to also in the way you approach fiction, is really important. I think it's something that I've come to understand better myself as I've gotten a little bit older, and particularly as I've become a parent. If I am in a good mental state when I'm parenting, if I walk into it with energy, if I walk into it having gotten enough sleep, I can be so much more present and so much more kind than if not. And I've come to think a lot more of life is managing the mental state you have before an event, an interaction, a challenge, than it is on simply having knowledge of how you want to respond to such things rattling around in your head.
100%. I agree with that so much. You know, it's kind of like if someone said, I aspire to be a marathon runner, so I will go out and run 24 miles. That's not going to work so well. And you know, what you're saying to me is really the essence of what I would consider a spiritual life, which is to say, there have been so many states of mind that I've occupied that I have at the time mistaken for George. if I step back at this age of 62 and look at all those states, first of all, none of them abided for very long. Second of all, I could say that I really prefer, you know, mine state 6D to this other one. You know, there were some that were more centered, they were more loving, they were more capacious, whatever you want to say. So to my way of thinking, once you say, oh yeah, I've been in at least two different mind states and they weren't identical, that's kind of the whole thing. Because really that's all that we have is the possible control over the mind state that we find ourselves in, which is both terrifying and exciting. But that's how, you know, I first got interested in meditation through my wife. And she's a brilliant person and writer. And she went into it first. And I noticed suddenly, you know, how in a marriage, you have certain fights all the time, you know, or tussles or whatever. Suddenly, she was just beautifully, skillfully guiding us around them after only a couple of weeks of meditation. And when I first started, I had maybe an experience like you did. Our kids were little. And there was just a split second of delay between a thought and word, which was really helpful. You know, you could just in a split second say, do I really want to say that? Or am I just saying this out of some kind of anxiety? And it's kind of mind blowing that that's actually the whole game in life, I think.
You said that for you, there's a very deep, you called it a beautiful conversation between fiction and meditation. They work on the same level. I've meditated, but I've never really written fiction. So tell me about that.
I guess for me, the common thing, and again, this is all from my beginner perspective, but there's something about the falling away of rumination in both those states. So, you know, my usual state is running around the house with my little monkey mind, talking about my latest experience or aspiring to some victory or defending myself. When I sit down to write fiction, because my attention is focused on an object, which is a paragraph or something, and it's done in what I would call like almost an athletic stance where I'm not theorizing or conceptualizing. I'm just in it. Like I'm hearing it a little bit in my head and I'm messing around with it a little bit. But the monkey mind goes quiet because I think the neural energy is being all channeled to that, the concentration on the prose about which I have very strong opinions. So in that experience, the ruminating mind goes somewhat more quiet and that's great. And now in meditation, I think something similar happens. And I'm not experienced enough exactly to say what that is. But the common thing would be a concentration on a task and then a related reduction in rumination. You know, the mind is so busy all the time. And what it's really doing is it's basically creating yourself. It's creating you, this illusory thing called you. And when the thoughts die down, then that self-creation gets a little less energetic. And in my experience, something else happens or something else rises up in that space that you've created. And that's true, I think, in meditation and in writing.
I always thought, or I came to meditation with the idea that it would quiet rumination for me. Certainly, it can do that. But more often, it forces me to confront how much rumination is actually happening, which can be a bit of a intimidating thing. I'll often have this moment where I realize to myself, this is what is happening all the time. Like, this is how loud it is in there. And I'm just constantly trying to distract myself from that noise with Twitter and with, as you put it, you know, thoughts of my victories and, you know, having a whiskey and whatever it might be. So that's partially why there are periods I find meditation hard. If my mind is unsettled, it can sometimes be hard for me to just simply see on the cushion just how loud it is.
Yeah, but I think from my point of view, that's a huge thing because basically it's sort of meditation as cracking open the owner's manual. For all my life, for much of my life, I had a mental fog going on, a monkey mind that for me was just an identity with me. That was not anything created or external or weird. It was just me. And I think that anything that can make you realize that that thing is just a sort of a freak of your birth. You know, it's like it's a series of brain farts, essentially. Now they're systematic. They, you know, they're similar to the brain farts you were having when you were 10, but they're not you. So when I was first starting to meditate, I noticed almost exactly like what you're saying. I noticed a certain pessimistic or snarky cast to my default mind. You know, I walk into a party and I was just looking for things to kind of lightly make fun of. Probably a defense mechanism, but also it was fun, you know? So what was really useful about that was to say, oh, wait a minute, that's not me. And it's certainly not true of the party. It's just a feature of this particular mind, you know? And writing does the same thing for me. If I put out a first draft and there's a certain writer represented therein, and then you start rewriting it. And for me, it's a really long process. But by the end, there's a different person represented, and it's a person that I like better. So in other words, that first, the mind that appeared in the first draft was just some mind, you know? It doesn't have to be identified with me. The process of working through it, suddenly you see, oh, there's a lot of minds along the way. And that to me is a really beautiful and kind of addicting experience. You know, I don't ever want to be the person who speaks or thinks in first draft mind.
Something that I want to key in on there that you've talked about elsewhere is this idea of intuition as being an important part of writing. It is a very strange experience, at least for me, to have a thought emerge seemingly out of nowhere that is more insightful and deeper than I tend to think I am. And then it's similarly a little bit strange to have thoughts emerging constantly that are about things I don't want to be thinking about. And I do think about meditation, but also about the fiction writing process as you've described it, as about trying to hear quieter voices in your own mind and make more space for them. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the role of intuition, what you understand intuition to be, and how you open yourself up to it.
Sure. For me, intuition is kind of like, let's say you're at the park and some people nearby are playing Frisbee and they miss throw and it's coming right at you and you could catch it and you do. There's no thought in that. It's just kind of oh, that'll be interesting, you know. In writing, what it means to me is that, so if you're a language person, you have a bunch of micro opinions about prose that are available to you all the time. You've been using them all your life since you were a little kid. So for me, part of the sort of trajectory of becoming a better writer is to just start listening to those little opinions, you know, believing in their existence, getting better at discerning them, and then getting better at instantaneously acting on them. And none of that really involves a lot of thinking or a lot of deciding or thematic conceptualization. It's literally just like catching that Frisbee. Or like going to the optometrist, you know, do like this choice better or that choice better. So the kind of amazing truth in my experience is that that's the whole game for a writer is you have a lot of opinions that most of the time you override or miss. Can you slow down a little bit in your revision process and find out what those are and then radically honor them? That's what makes a writer distinctive, I would say. So there's not much to that really, except cultivating that state of mind.
Yeah, I want to push on that a little bit because the Frisbee analogy strikes me as interestingly different. The thing about catching the Frisbee, I would think of that as a reflex because I don't need to think about it. It'll happen almost whether I wanted to or not. Whereas it strikes me, or I think, that what you're talking about requires some real energy and space to hear that. It'd be very easy to miss that voice. You have a line in the new book there where you say, "That's what craft is. A way to open ourselves up to the superpersonal wisdom within us." And I want to see if you could talk a bit about that. How does craft or how do other practices create the space to notice those intuitions, to notice those new thoughts, to notice the things that are happening on that more micro level?
Sure. The analogy would be you're reading a phrase of yours and something hits you as being a happier phrasing. In other words, the impulse to catch a Frisbee was present and you honored it. And when you're hitting a phrase that you don't like of yours, it's the same feeling. I'll just say for me, I have cultivated a revision practice that is 100% dependent on this kind of moment we're talking about, the state of mind we're talking about. If I do that over time, I think that's the conduit for this, what Kundera called the super personal wisdom to come in. So it's kind of a fancy way of saying that your stories start making more sense with revision over the course of a document, thousands of times you're deciding what is truer, what's more vivid, what has less deception in it. And over the course of revising it, the whole story comes up and it starts to become a more intense, honest investigation of whatever you're looking at. That's kind of what I think happens. And again, I'm really kind of slippery on this subject because I don't really understand why it should be that way. But I just have the experience that, you know, an early story of mine will be kind of facile and probably politically charged with a lot of obvious liberal conceits. And the basic mechanism is me and the reader are mocking somebody down below us. And then over the many, many drafts, the thing actually changes and becomes fairer and funnier and smarter and so on.
Tell me about that revision process. So you begin with that draft, you have that draft, which has its obvious opinions and it's punching down. And then what happens, both just literally, like there are 8 drafts and you work on them all in the mornings before 10 a.m. And then it feels to you internally between there and the product I end up reading?
Yeah, mostly. I mean, you know, it's different every time, but mostly it's I'll print out a nice clean copy the day before and then, you know, just by hook or crook, sit down in front of it and start reading it with a pen in hand, pencil in hand. And then in the book, I describe this kind of metaphor, which isn't, of course, literally true, but it's pretty close. There's a like meter in my head with P on one side for positive and for negative. My idea is that the meter responds when I read prose. Just like when you're in a bookstore and you pick up a book, you're either still reading an hour later or you toss it aside. So the whole thing for me is to be reading my work as if I didn't write it, you know, as if I just found it on a bus seat or something. And then all the time, another part of the mind is watching that meter, basically saying, what would a first-time reader be feeling right now? In or out, in or out. And it's all happening in a split second. None of that, the meter is not there, but in a split second, I'm going, ah. So there's a certain feeling I'm hoping for, which is a kind of a amused engagement, like, yeah, yeah, okay, sure, sure. Then you hit a bit of ice, you know, it's something that's suddenly like, ugh, the needle goes into the negative, or something about the sentence just feels like it isn't right. Sometimes it's a feeling that it's too banal, it's a sentence anybody else could have written, or sometimes the logic goes off. You know, you're saying something that is forced or isn't true. And then part of this process that might relate back to meditation is that at that point, you got some choices. One is to say to your internal needle, bullshit, you're wrong. It was perfect yesterday. You know, that's not the best response. The other thing is to sort of say gently, okay, all right, duly noted. How about if I just go past you and I'll read it again in an hour or so and see if I still agree with you? If so, I'll make a change. Or the best thing is when you just, in an instant, like that Frisbee, you go, oh, I can just cut this phrase. And if I cut that phrase, that moment of resistance would be less, you know? So it's that. And then practically speaking, in a good writing day, I might get through, you know, like a 7-page story 2 or 3 times in that spirit. And I'll make the changes, put them in, print it out, read it again. And then at that time, I can feel something start to go a little bit loose in my head where I'm not really as discerning as I should be. And I'm starting to make changes just for the sake of it. And then I'll quit. So the act of faith is that if I do that thing that I just described for many, many days and weeks and months, at some point I can get through the whole thing with the needle up in the positive area. Another way of saying it is you've basically brought many different yous to the table. You brought the, you know, the anal retentive you and the self-celebrating you and the grouchy you and the funny thing is over time it does kind of stabilize into something that you can read over and over with mostly positive feelings. And that, weirdly, and I can't explain it, is related to this thing we talked about earlier, that the person who's present in that 900th draft is somewhat above me on the intelligence scale and on the compassion scale and on the wit scale.
So I think that's actually a good bridge to the new book. And so for people who haven't read it yet, and people should, it is built around 7 Russian short stories that you teach, and you're working through the logic, and I would also say in different ways, the message of them. And so I wanted to look at a couple of them more closely. So let's begin with The Master and the Man, which I have to say, I never read. It's by Tolstoy. It just rocked me. It is such an incredible story. Can you summarize it, or do you think that does too much violence to it to do?
No, I think it's, you know, basically, like a lot of these stories, it's really kind of almost like a joke. Because, you know, the thing is a rich man and his servant go out to close a business deal at the rich man's probably unreasonable insistence, and they drive right into a snowstorm. And then, I guess without giving away, I would say the story quickly tells us that what it's about is, can that rich guy, who's a, you know, arrogant, oppressive, mansplaining, imperialist pig, can he change? And then Tolstoy takes it up one more level and says, okay, if he can change, how exactly? You know, what's the mechanism? And then the feeling for the reader is that it's a reflection on, can anybody change? You know, can any of us change? And if so, how might that happen?
Something you write in your commentary on that story is that Tolstoy is proposing something radical, moral transformation, when it happens not through the total remaking of the sinner or the replacement of his habitual energy with some pure new energy, but by a redirection of his same old energy. And I loved that idea that we are as we are on some level. And the question isn't, I think, the one we often ask, which is how can we fundamentally change? But it's how do we redirect that nature constructively, or that energy constructively, or how do we put ourselves in a context where the things that make us up are adaptive as opposed to maladaptive?
Right. I mean, so it's like earlier when we were talking about our respective energetic monkey minds, I don't think that's going to stop. I've had it my whole life. So the question is, what do you do with that, you know, that feature? One thing that I, you know, kind of associate with maybe traditional religions is cut it out, just stop it, you know, disavow it, eradicate it. That seems to me not right. So then the alternative is, well, let's, you know, you've got this rushing river. If you route it through a kindergarten, that's not so good. If you route it through a dam with a generator, that's good. So to me, that's sort of a hopeful thing to say we aren't going to change our fundamental energies. You know, everybody's born with hunger and you could disavow it, you know, which seems kind of babyish to me. Or you could say, okay, given that I'm hungry, there are lots of possibilities. I could become a complete overeater to the detriment of my health. I could eat nails. I could, you know, whatever. Or I could become an incredible chef who uses that propensity for good. Or I could just moderate it and try, you know. So in that story, he's got some really nice qualities that he's always channeled to egotism, basically. And in the final moments of his life, something very magical happens and he just slightly makes his gate a little wider and includes this one other person in that. And so he goes sort of immediately from a bad person to somebody who's actually almost saintly. But he doesn't really change, actually. His fundamental nature doesn't change.
You wrote about that. You gave this example that stuck with me for a reason that will become obvious in a second, where you wrote, look, say you're a world-class warrior. If that worry energy gets directed at extreme personal hygiene, you're neurotic. If it gets directed at climate change, you're an intense visionary activist. And it reminded me of something that my wife once said to me, that it actually, there are very few moments like this, but it completely changed my view of my own nature and my own history and the story I told about it. I was a pretty bad hypochondriac when I was younger. And I told her that I was glad she didn't meet me then because I was just always worrying and who'd like that guy. And she said to me, oh, you haven't changed at all. You just hadn't found work yet. And now you just put all that worry and energy there.
That's beautiful. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm
and
talking
about.
And
I was totally floored by that because it made total sense. It's just the same energy, but now it makes me, by society standards, successful rather than neurotic.
Yeah.
But it is a lot of neurotic energy.
Yeah.
It's just being channeled.
But what a lovely way for her to see you too. That's really a gift. You know, that's because when you talk about acceptance, that's really what we're talking about is you're born a certain way. And, you know, nobody chooses the packaging with which they're born. And then the question is, okay, given this, you know, you do have some choice in how you disperse it, I guess.
This episode is supported by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Hosted by Katie Milkman, an award-winning behavioral scientist and author of the best-selling book, How to Change, Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Hear true stories from Nobel laureates, authors, athletes, and more about why we do the things we do. Listen to Choiceology at schwab.com/podcast or wherever you listen.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
So I read an old interview with you where you said that the best thing that happened to you is you worked for engineering companies, and that's where you found your material. And I'm quoting you here, in the everyday struggle between capitalism and grace. I'd like to hear more about that, but particularly from this perspective, that capitalism is a system, that it directs the energies we already have in some directions and not others. It pulls out parts of our psyche, desire for status, desire for positional status, desire to achieve. And it's able to do some productive things with them and then maybe also some more dangerous things with them. And so I'd like to hear a little bit about how you see capitalism as channeling the sort of natural human nature. How does it change us? How does it affect us?
What it makes me think is that we always have to be asking, which capitalism are we subscribing to? So you could imagine one model that's quite generous and that sort of builds into itself some humanistic values. And just by a slight turn of the dial, which, by the way, I think has happened during my lifetime, that capitalism becomes more rapacious and more neglectful of the individual. So I think for me, the interesting thing is, how do we set that dial? How does the discourse that we engage in as a country cause that adjustment of the dial to go in the direction of actual goodness? You know, I don't think there's anything implicitly wrong with capitalism, but it's where you set the dial. In my experience, what happened was, you know, we had our daughters and Paul and I got married pretty quickly and had children right away, and we had no money. So in a very babyish bourgeois way, I could just see or could feel the way that the society was pressuring me and was kind of causing a lot of my qualities like anxiety and perfectionism to torment me a little bit, and was undercutting my grace, you know, my ability to be joyful and rise to the occasion. So really, it was just an extrapolation that if me, you know, a guy with a relatively okay job and a relatively okay mind and good health and so on, was feeling that pressure, suddenly I looked up and like, oh my God, this is what cultural discontent is about, is that the capitalist dragon has its claw on everybody's throat and it's pressing down at different levels to everybody. So that became very important to me. It's a very small, you know, I should have had that realization immediately in my life, but it took a bit of difficulty to bring it out.
This is such a rich subject right here that I've been thinking about a bit myself, which is capitalism and kids and having kids in this context. So I have a 2-year-old, so doesn't feel so new anymore, but a newish parent. And I guess I'll approach it this way. I read something, it's actually in the same interview that you said, that the big turning point in my artistic life was when my wife and I had our kids. The world got infused with morality again. Every person in the world should theoretically be loved as much as I love my daughters. And on the one hand, I really feel that. I found becoming a parent to be a really startling window into how I treat other people and to how other people deserve to be treated. And at the same time, I notice how easily it can tip the other way, that the particularistic love we feel, or maybe I should just say that I feel for my children or those close to me, it can close you off to the world and make you more intent on protecting them and getting what they need and in ways that hurt others. You have this super haunting story, the Semplico Girls Diaries, that to me reads is all about this, where this father he is so concerned about his daughter's status concerns and pain at school that he doesn't notice, and in many ways his whole society can't see what they're doing to others. But I'd be interested to hear you talk a bit about that, because it does seem to me that positional capitalism and the way it interacts with, it allows us to justify a lot on the basis of, well, we need to protect our children, when you might think that the feelings we have towards our children would actually open us up more to other people's children.
Yeah, that's a brilliant point, Ezra. And I think, I'm gonna cornily invoke a Buddhist fable here. You know, the Buddha had a wonderful student who was a musician, and the student was trying to figure out if, when meditating, a person should be really like taught with attention and really almost militantly attentive, or he'd also heard that it was relaxing, you know, so which one was it? And the Buddha said something like, well, when you're tuning up your guitar, your stringed instrument, do you want it to be too tight or too loose? And of course he said, well, you know, you want it to be just right. I'm like, yeah. So in so many things in life and in our culture, it would be nice if we could just settle on one extreme or the other and have one autopilot setting, put your kids above everything else. That would be nice. But experience tells us that the pisser is we have to always be setting the dial, and not just like once every 3 years, like every moment you have to be resetting the dial. And this is another kind of thing I learned from fiction, is the truths that you might say that are separate from questions of to whom, under what conditions, on what day, those truths are not that interesting to me. In other words, am I for assisted suicide, say, I really feel there's a certain wisdom in saying by whom, on what day, under what conditions, and almost like reflexively asking that. It keeps us out of the danger of generalization, which I think in our public discourse is so pervasive, and it results in so much agitation when we're asking people to decide general conditions. And fiction reminds us that you can't really write a good story without specifying who it's happening to, under what conditions, on what day. So that would be kind of my long-winded answer to your question about child raising, which is, yeah, you're exactly right. And that's what we have to sort of titrate, you know, every day.
I like that. And we are very much going to come back to that who, under what conditions, at what times question, because it's something that is laced through, I think, your work, but also in a very different way, mine. And I want to get at that interface. But I actually want to talk about one of the other short stories you discuss in the new book, which is The Nose. That one's a more fun one to summarize. So do you mind doing it?
Yeah. A guy wakes up and he finds a nose in his breakfast. He doesn't know where it came from. And we cut away to the guy whose nose it is, who goes in search of it. And then it shows up as a kind of like 6'2" nose that gets out of a carriage. And the guy, you know, runs around trying to get his nose back on his face, basically. When you put it that way, it sounds so crazy.
Well, you write about it that Gogol, who's the author, is sometimes, and whose name I probably just mispronounced, is sometimes referred to as an absurdist, his work meant to communicate that we live in a world without meaning. But to me, Gogol is a supreme realist, looking past the way things seem to how they really are. So why is a story about a 6'2" nose running around getting in and out of carriages a story about the way things really are?
Right. I think it goes back to what we were discussing earlier. You know, we come out of the womb with a bunch of really amazing sensory apparatuses and with this brain at the top of it all. And instantly we are there, you know, George is there, Ezra is there. I can remember even as a three-year-old, like, oh, I'm in a movie and I'm the star of it, you know, and I'll be in this movie forever. So that feeling is not right, you know, it's incorrect. And we can look down the line and see people that are a little older than us dying, you know, and so it should be obvious, but it isn't. So what do? Well, we take that little thinking apparatus, which is so woefully inadequate to reality. And what else are we going to do? We assume that it's giving us good data. And we're thinking all the time. And the thinking makes us and it makes a world. And we blunder out into that. And then we meet somebody else who's doing the same exact thing on the sidewalk. And hilarity ensues because the constructed worlds that we both have made aren't in agreement often. They might be in agreement broadly. You know, we might both agree that that's a duck there on the sidewalk with us, but the more nuanced parts of that construction are not in agreement. So that's scary, but it's also really funny. It's what causes basically funny shit to happen. And it's also what causes genocides to happen and divorces and beautiful weekends in the Poconos. So to me, that Gogol is somebody who is able to say, when we look at two people in a room, we're basically looking at two insane entities who both think they're not only sane, but preeminent. It's a totally natural result of the physicality. And both of them are trying to do this very human thing, which is to assert control over their environment. Like, I'm a husband, a father, a professor, and a writer. You know, you've got your constructed view of yourself. Usually that view puts you at the top of the heap in any situation you're in. But because all of that's false, it leads to the drama of human life. And I think Gogol somehow, by starting with that precept, and the way he does it is he has, even his narrator is a screw up. His narrator is really subjective and a little bit unskillful in the way he expresses himself. So that guy's messed up. The characters also reason badly, and they reason very selfishly. So you have at any given time, two or three or four machines that aren't reasoning very well and that are positioning themselves as little gods in the world. And it's crazy. It's funny. But in a certain way, it seems like the most accurate assessment of what's actually going on here that I've ever read.
There's another thing you draw out of that story that you gestured at there, which is the way in which everybody in that story, but then I think of this as characterizing a lot of your work, and then I think of this as characterizing a lot of our world, will treat the most insane happenings as normal, so long as everybody else is treating them as normal. That the human capacity to baseline whatever is going on around, no matter how extreme, no matter how grotesque, no matter how bizarre, is just really, really high. And that's one of the really profound forces, on the one hand, holding society together, but on the other hand, often protecting some of the worst elements of society from attention and maybe reform.
Yeah, I think it's true. You know, you could see, I mean, the Trump era is an obvious example where what would have been absolutely unimaginable becomes normalized really quickly. And then it takes a lot of work, I think, to stay in a state of alertness where you're seeing a certain behavior correctly relative to the previous baseline. But as you're saying, it's probably necessary. I mean, look how quickly we learn to live in quarantine. And now I have a hard time imagining not being in it, you know? So I guess, like so many things, it's kind of a double-edged sword. It's appalling that we would have somebody we care about die, and then within a couple months, basically be back to normal. That's crazy, but it's also, you know, absolutely necessary.
Yeah, that's a really lovely example. I'm going to take us to the Trump era in a second, but in some ways, I feel like the Trump era is too easy of an example because too many people believe it. Too many people looked at it, and I want to talk to you about this, and said, this is wild what is happening here. I'm a vegan, and so one of the examples I'll give is I find this to be very true about animal suffering. In a previous podcast, I called it the green pill, that once you start taking the suffering of tens of billions of animals that we raise for food seriously, the world becomes really gruesome looking, that people you love and respect are constantly partaking in a terrible system of cruelty, but you seem like the weird one if you point it out. And before anybody thinks I'm just up on a high horse about this, although obviously I am a little bit, you could make this argument about me on, say, climate change. Before the pandemic, I took flights different places, right? And I certainly don't live a low-carbon lifestyle compared to people around this world. Or there's this very famous thought experiment by the ethical philosopher Peter Singer about, you know, would you jump in a pond to save a drowning child? Well, what if it would make your suit messed up? And you say, of course, I'd get my suit dry cleaned. Who cares? And then he says, well, why won't you spend that dry clean money to save a child on another continent? What is the difference between them being in the pond and being in another country? And to just move through the world day by day, you have to abide such a high level of moral outrage. And on the one hand, if you open yourself up to it, it's paralyzing. But if you close yourself down to it, it's deadening.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I feel that. In Buddhism, sometimes they talk about absolute versus relative. So in a relative sense, that's exactly right. And I think we all suffer from that. We all feel that, whether we know we're feeling it or not, we feel that contradiction. On the absolute sense, I don't know, or maybe this is more like as an artist, I think, well, it's a version of the poor have always been with us. Like, yeah, that's true. It's terrible. And in a relative sense, I want to work as hard as I can to not participate in any system that's corrupt. And yet, what state of mind are you left in since you can't actually do that? I'm going to become tormented, neurotic, and a little bitter, constantly noticing only the most horrible things. So I guess there's part of my mind that says, yeah, okay, we want to notice that. We want to do everything we can in the relative frame. And then at some higher level, you want to go, oh, interesting that that's the way it looks to us. And I would say my own judgmental moral perfectionism, if I really look at it, it has a lot to do with illusion of control. It has to do with me somewhat overestimating my place in this world. So there's an element of ego in it that says, I'm going to destroy my life with regret, as opposed to saying, yeah, you know, you're just a little speck that came here quickly and in a very big system that you don't understand. And there's some value in acceptance, or kind of like, I don't know, I'm not really being very clear on this, but I hear what you're saying. It's kind of, I think it's one of the tenets of that show, The Good Place, you know, like if a person takes it as his responsibility to right every wrong, that's a big, I don't know, I'm not really sure.
I love that show. I love that show so much. But I don't know, I always thought that last move they ran, and I'm sorry, they're Good Place spoilers here. The point system has become totally destroyed by the world being too complex to actually correctly assess any actions. It's a little bit of a cop-out, like a little bit too utilitarian, where I will say this is particularly an issue on the left, in my view. There is, or certainly has become, such a dominant argument against individualizing any systemic problems. Like if you talk at all about anybody's individual responsibility on something like climate change, you'll immediately be told, well, no, the real question here is, what do we do with the top corporate polluters? And I agree on some level. The real question, I mean, I spend my life doing policy journalism. I obviously agree that systemic solutions are the ones we need. But I do, there's another part of me that thinks you don't get systemic solutions if people let themselves too off the hook for their individual responsibility and problems. Like, people don't certainly vote to tax themselves on things that they don't think are wrong. Now, you can't ask anybody to be perfect. And I had Peter Singer show a while back, and even he didn't say, you know, donate 80% of your income to global poverty, or even 50% of your income to global poverty. But I think there is something difficult in the question of, what does it mean that we can be okay with how much of this there is? And that, you know, saying that, well, we can't change it all can be a little bit too much letting ourselves off the hook.
So as a writer, what I'm interested in is how might I change my inner state so that I would understand the world in such a way that I would do less harm? That's, for me, the starting place. And then, to the extent that I'm not doing that, I think I'm skipping ahead a couple of steps, maybe. But I think what you're saying really is true. And it's one of the crazy dilemmas of this life. I used to work in a slaughterhouse, you know, and that was amazing that I could do that and still be a sporadic meat eater. And that suffering was real, for sure. You know, not only the animals, but the other workers. That was real suffering. So I don't know. I mean, maybe the question is, how are we if we can't come up with an answer? You know, how do we, what do the days look like? Can we learn to live in a world where there is a lot of that kind of evil going around, and at the same time not make monsters of ourselves? Honestly, there are times where I'm just sort of beyond my pay grade, and this is why I tend to think a little more in the terms of stories, I guess.
I totally hear that. But that's actually why I use Gogol as a direction into this, and I'll take this in a slightly different direction now, which is that I thought your insight, both about his fiction, but I also think this is true about your fiction. I would really recommend that people read that story of yours, The Semplica Girl Diaries, because I think it does this beautifully. And I think something that it makes me think about in my own work is that it's really important not to let things become normal just because they are wrapped in normal language. So you brought up the Trump presidency here, and that was the direction I'd wanted to go, which is, I've written, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of words on that presidency, maybe more. But in a way, I think simply being forced into the language of political journalism, I've never been able to, and I will never be able to, convey how truly weird and disturbing it was. And somehow for everyone to talk about it all at once, it normalizes it almost by definition, because anything that happens at that scale is normal almost by definition. And yet there's this part of me that wants to insist that it isn't. So I guess, how does a novelist in you read this era? How would you try to convey what it felt like?
Well, you know, one of the things that I have noticed is that our leftist shock at Trump was valid. You know, it's absolutely correct. And yet, you know, it happened and it is still happening. So the novelist in me says, okay, duly noted, a left-wing person of this era would have a certain quality of shock that could go in a book. Well, on the other side, you go over there and there are 60 million people for whom this is not shocking, but lovely. It's almost like if somebody, you know, you see a caveman and he picks up a grenade, you know, and he thinks it's a pineapple and it blows up. It's kind of on the caveman, you know, he misunderstood that grenade. So I think for me, just personally, I covered the Trump campaign in 2016 and I was totally shocked and didn't have a vocabulary and realized there was all kinds of subterranean things going on I had no clue about on the right. And now what I've been trying to do since then is just get over the shock and start to try to understand the system that existed before Trump in such a way that it makes sense. Not to say that I approve of it or that I won't resist it, but that it makes holistic sense, because cause and effect never takes a break. So whatever happened there in 2016 and is still happening, it's got an organic cause. And I think for me, the version of me that was hand-wringing and I can't believe it, that part needs to be over. And I'm trying to be a scientist about it and understand it in a deeper way, which is both a way of finding a way to write about it, but also it's actually a way to find the best way to push against it. Diagnosis is a really important, and diagnosis from inside with some kind of psychological insight into it and a novelistic insight is, in my way of thinking, the best way to position oneself for resistance.
Someone once told me that whenever you think, that doesn't make sense, that what it means is your model of the world doesn't make sense, that the world always makes sense on its own terms. It's you who is missing something. And so that's always a starting point for inquiry. And so I actually want to go back, because one thing I will say about your nonfiction is that there is a really powerful predictive dimension in it to this era. You wrote a piece many, many, many years ago now on the Minutemen, who were this militia, this sort of right-wing militia, but also kind of cosplay militia that would stand in border towns with guns and hang out waiting to see immigrants crossing the border and then try to, you know, get them picked up by the Border Patrol. And at the time, it all looked very weird. It was, you know, people who seemed to be pretending they were somehow soldiers in some grand war. And there's an absurdity in the piece, but you read it now and it is so predictive of Trump. It was so predictive of what was really happening on the right and the power of the immigration narrative. And he just comes up a couple years later and picks that up. And I'm curious how you think back on the people you met then, on that piece, on just that whole moment.
Yeah, you know, it's what I love about writing nonfiction is you blunder into a situation and usually your conceptual apparatus isn't prepared. Like, I didn't even know what to make of those guys, you know. So in that situation, what you have to resort to is just observing. Usually I go into those pieces with a kind of an agenda, an idea for what the piece will look like. And within the first couple of days, it gets totally destroyed by, you know, reality. So I love that feeling of like sitting out there with them. We staked out the border for a whole night, this six of us or 12 of us or whatever. And they were all heavily armed. And it was funny. It was a comical evening that could have been a tragic evening. It almost was at one point. But what I love to say, holy shit, I really don't know what's going on here. And in a way, that's another example of the ruminating mind going quiet. Because since all your rumination-based concepts are totally wrong, totally at odds with what's happening in front of you, you have to put those away, and then you're all eyes, ears, nose, and note-taking. So that's why I think those pieces, if they have any value, it's that in those moments, all my circa whatever it was, 2006 liberal ideas had to be shut down for a minute, and it was just observing what they actually said and did. Yeah, it was a very, very wild piece, because they were certainly affable with me, you know. And I think I say in the piece, four or five of them is a lot of fun, but you put 400 or 500 and it's a different ballgame. And now we see the Capitol being stormed.
There is this way right now in which things that seem comic very quickly tip into things that are dangerous or tragic. And people keep experiencing that as some kind of surprise, that there's a contradiction or a tension there. When certainly I've come to believe that those things are related, they're more causal, actually, that the comic nature allows things to spread, to not be seen as dangerous, and then they become dangerous. But you see that in the Capitol insurrectionists, right? There's a sort of ridiculousness to, you know, this guy in the shaman hat running in, but there's also a bunch of people with guns. You see it in the Minutemen. You see it in the Tea Party. But of course, you see it going way back, right? Fascism is a bunch of friends dressing up in similar outfits to sing songs together, but then it's fascism. And I'm curious, as somebody who often uses comedy to try to get at what is truer and sometimes more destructive in the world, just how you read that.
I always think of that movie Fargo as a great example of that. You know, those killers are so inept and so stupid, and yet they really kill, you know. I think of myself really in an honorable tradition of Shakespearean fools, you know, who come into a situation and they're not, you know, that well informed or that well read necessarily. They're just kind of riffing. And the power of the Shakespearean fool is that he riffs really well and he blunders into the truth in the spirit of trying to entertain or trying to captivate. So for me, the trick is, you know, try to live my life in such a way that I'm not pre-shaping experiences too much. Try to go into places that make me uncomfortable or that I think I'm sure about, but including some really just boring old banal places, you know, that aren't, and always keep my eyes and ears open. And then in a certain way to try not to build up a view of the world. Now you do, of course you do, but try not to. And then when I get in front of a story that I'm writing, this subconscious thing we were talking about kicks in. And it produces all kinds of weird gems and weird juxtapositions and tonalities that I could never have thought of in advance. So again, it's that idea that it's intuition as this conduit that provides a level of complexity that might have a sort of super truth in it. You know, it's not necessarily linear truth or everyday truth, but there's a kind of overcharged quality that allows it to sometimes be predictive. Or what I'm working on now is sort of trying to write a piece that feels like right now and you know, you're sort of taking different valences that are in the culture and putting them in action. And sometimes if you do that, they will inadvertently do something that leads you to a higher understanding of things. But again, not a rational understanding. I think it's more of a, there's a kind of a magic in it. And I don't really even know what the function is, except I think if you read something in that spirit, something that, as you were saying, combines the comic and the tragic, there's just an instantaneous coming alive of something in your consciousness that I think is what's fun. And I suppose you could argue that it's beneficial.
This podcast is supported by Mercy Corps. From war in Ukraine to flooding in Pakistan to earthquakes in Afghanistan, Mercy Corps is delivering urgent humanitarian assistance and long-term solutions to families in crisis around the globe. Visit mercycorps.org/donate to learn more and support lasting solutions in over 40 countries. That's mercy, CORPS.org/donate, to help build a future where everyone can flourish.
This gets us back to something I had put a pin in earlier when you talked about the key question of fiction being under what conditions, at what time, in which place, right? The conditions that bring out certain versions of us rather than others. And I obviously see this in your fiction, but it is almost pathological in your nonfiction, like the effort to inhabit other perspectives. It's in every piece I've read from you. It's in your remarkable 2016 piece in The New Yorker on Trump rallies. But I want to read some quotes here from this Minuteman piece you write, that everyone's pissed, oppositional, less empathetic and articulate and well-mannered than they would be at any other moment in their actual lives. And then in your piece on the Trump rallies, you talk about trying to present people with the specifics of the folks they want to deport. And you say, in the face of specificity, my interviewees began really trying to think of what would be fairest and most humane for this real person we had imaginatively conjured up. It wasn't that we suddenly agreed, but the tone changed. But then, of course, a couple minutes later, you're in a crowd of counter-protesters and the guy's screaming, Hillary's going to be locked up, she won't be president. This feels like a really important practice to me. And then also, there sometimes feels like there's a way of searching so determinedly for the multitudes we carry inside of ourselves that it can almost blind us to the people we are being right now when it matters most. That it can become exculpatory when we actually need to be forced to be responsible for who we are in this moment. And I'm curious how you think about that tension.
Yeah, it's a beautifully made point. First of all, we have to say that each of us has different bandwidth or different inclinations or superpowers. So I would never, you know, advocate for a general anything. But for me, what I find is if I'm in the face of somebody with whom I don't agree, I'm pretty comfortable with the moment when I have to fight them. I don't really have a big problem with that. I'm usually pretty clear on where my lines are and when somebody needs to be forcibly pushed back. So I think what that does is it gives me a little bit of an option to engage another interest of mine, which is to say, how does the world look through that person's eyes? He sounds insane. You know, he sounds aggressive. He sounds irrational. He sounds racist. But to him, it feels differently. Now, usually when people advocate going into consciousness, they're saying something like, be empathetic and be loving and you can change the person or, you know, whatever. There's also a kind of a power in it to say, you know, if I want you to stop doing something and I'm confident that at the moment I need to, I can and will fight you, then I have a little side corridor, which is to try to imagine what the world looks like to you. If I can do that, that gives me a range of persuasive options, you know, that are more powerful than if I didn't think about you. Now, again, for a lot of people, I think that's just weird and they don't want to do it. But for me, ever since I was a little kid, I've had that interest in how, you know, that person seems to be other than me. And yet to her, she seems like this central story. So maybe that's why I became a fiction writer, but I like doing that. And I think it's powerful. And I think I have maybe more bandwidth for it than a lot of people do. But you have to be very careful that it can easily morph over into enabling. You know, if I understand why somebody does something, it doesn't permit it. So to me, it's a natural thing. I enjoy it. Yeah, it's tricky. And by the way, I've never persuaded anybody. That whole Trump rally, I talk to everybody. I have all kinds of people in my extended social circle that are Trumpies, I've never, you know, never budged anybody. So, you know, but it makes me feel less insane if I can somehow, at least for little brief moments, see things from their point of view.
One reason I connect to this is it makes me feel less insane too. It's in many ways my most natural mode. And then I find that there is a part of me that wants to believe in the least insane, or to put it differently than that, the least offensive to me version of the person in front of me. And I do a lot. I'm a political reporter, so I spend a lot of my time talking with Republican members of Congress and Republican staffers in Congress. And a constant theme for me in recent years, and there are a lot of Republicans who, you know, I don't agree with them on things, but I respect their differences and the way they think about things, and I learn a lot from them. But there's also a strain of the party right now, just to be blunt about where I think things are, that has gone off the rails. And one of the things I would see all the time is members of Congress who would be reasoned and cautious and many-minded in their private conversations with me, and then would turn around and vote to reject the results of the election or to rip healthcare away from poor people, would lie about covering pre-existing conditions. And it just raises this very hard question for me, not of who we really are, because I don't think that has an answer. I think that, as you put it, who we are is situational. But of which of ourselves really matters, and of what do you do sometimes with the desire to believe the best in people when they're particularly not going to be in a system that is going to bring out their best self at the end of the day?
And how do you explain that? You know, having been in the position of seeing that, you know, the reasonable person on a small level and then the unreasonable public thing, how do you explain or understand that?
I think there are a lot of possible explanations. One is that the reasonable person is trying to convince me of their reasonableness, that it's not there, it's not even that true of a self. So that's one version. I always notice that people who I will, you know, I'll sometimes have on the show are much more reasonable or gentle than they are on Twitter, because when they're talking to me, they want to have like a nice social interaction, and on Twitter they want to dunk on people. So different contexts bring out different things in us, and that's, by the way, very much true for me. Another thing is that we live in a zero-sum political system. And so I wrote this book, Why We're Polarized, which is very much all about this question. It's very much about why it is on some basic level rational for even a Republican who didn't like Donald Trump on a personal level to have voted for him, certainly in 2016 and even in 2020, that the choice between the two parties is going to become so wide for people that particularly once you then add in media ecosystems that give people a very different view of what the reality is, that the choice makes sense from their perspective. But in terms of those members of Congress, I often think that at the end of the day, everything in Congress is a binary question, a yes or no on this bill. And then behind that yes or no on this bill, a who do you want to see win the next election? And so conversations are positive sum. There are a lot of ways to act in a conversation that make everybody better off. But when you end up in zero-sum choices, well, then in some ways, you really see what people's values are, right? And what they're willing to risk and which part of them was lying at bedrock. Because on the one hand, I can explain the rational reason people make these decisions, but I also don't want to let people too much off the hook for making careerist rational decisions, right? I want people to do, particularly in positions of leadership, the moral thing, even if it's hard. And so I really struggle with this. I think there's a kind of cognitive illusion that can emerge from trying too hard to steel man people's positions. And then you're surprised when they, you know, they act in less reasonable ways than that side of themselves they showed you.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think that's one of the values of great literature. You know, if you read Shakespeare, or there's a beautiful Chekhov story called In the Ravine, which is about one of the most unrelievedly evil people, a woman who scalds a baby to death at one point because it would help her in some way. And, you know, those great writers don't flinch about the idea that, okay, we have capabilities of empathy and understanding. And so in other words, you could, a great mind could get inside the mind of that woman and be her for a couple seconds. But that doesn't have anything to do with our response to her, or, you know, you don't want to enable her, or you don't want to even, you know, understanding and forgiving are kind of two different things. So I think one of the things that literature does is it reminds us that for all of our honorable desire to empathize and soften boundaries, there are outrageous occasions where there are people who are just, from our perspective, unremittingly evil, and, you know, there they are. You know, so you wouldn't, in other words, you wouldn't want empathy or some kind of construction about empathy to start lopping off pieces of reality and making them inadmissible.
And I'll add one thing to this, because it's something I find really difficult about this political era, when virtues become vices, or virtues can become enabling. Because I will say that I feel that this political era does not bring out the best in me. Sometimes the choices I have to make, or the answers I have to come to, are not what I wish they were. And you have a really nice moment in that Trump rally piece of wrestling with this. You write, "A bully shows up, is hateful, says things so crude we liberals are taken aback. We respond moderately. We keep waiting for supporters, helped along by how compassionately and measuredly we are responding to be persuaded. For the bully, this is perfect." And I've been thinking a little bit about that with the sudden calls for unity after the election from Republicans who voted to reject the election. I don't want to put this exactly all on them, but even that right there is my, you know, like that little voice inside being like, show some virtue coming out when, I mean, voting to reject the election was all on them. And so this moment where it feels that some of the temperamental virtues of liberal democracy are weaponized by those who don't believe in it feels really tough, because you want to be your best self in politics, but then, you know, there are certain kinds of people who can find the flaw in that, and bullies, put aside the unremittingly evil. I mean, that is the nature of the bully, to turn the system against the people who are operating within it.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that the left has to do is recognize that we really are, at a very basic level, you know, defending virtues like kindness and decency and equality. That's to me, that's the thing we have to concentrate on, that actually we're the true defenders of the constitutional ideas that say we really are hopeful that we'll have a beautiful country where everybody is equal. That's actually what we're working for. And don't get too distracted by the small storms on either side. To me, you know, if we think about unity, here's the one idea I have about this, and I'm not a very astute political thinker, but here's a sort of a hopeful metaphor. If you take 20,000 Americans and send them down to a baseball stadium and say, look, Republicans, you guys wear red, Democrats, you wear blue. We file into the stadium, and on second base is a podium, and a guy starts talking in an inflammatory way about immigration. Well, you know, there's no doubt about what's going to happen. There's going to be fights. Okay, so now rewind and say, first of all, dress however you want. Same people come in, and then at the critical moment, the Yankees and the Red Sox run out. You know, so suddenly there's a polarity shift there. You're going to have Red Sox fans who are liberal and conservative and so on. The tenor of this discussion is going to change, because we've been trained. We know how to amiably argue at baseball games. So my only kind of light thought is we have to get off the preconceived axis that tells us what political discourse consists of and what it sounds like. Now, here we go back to the local. What would that look like? I think the move is to sort of somehow destabilize the idea that politics is always national and start looking locally. How does my life actually look to me as I experience it in the next 24 hours? How much my political agitation is around things that are basically distant, unknowable, or mostly unknowable and conceptual? So I'm feeling that a lot of the anger comes from a feeling of disconnection. And that feeling of disconnection is actually correct. We're fighting like hell with people we care about in what's largely a predetermined discourse. Does that make any sense at all?
It makes a ton of sense. In fact, one reason I'm happy to hear you say it is one of the places my book ends is in a call for relocalizing a lot of politics for almost exactly that reason, that argues that the nationalization of politics has become a huge polarization driver. But I won't make this is about your book, not mine, but I can't really agree with that more. And I will say on one piece of that, even as I'm at the New York Times now and I live in California, one thing I always tell people is that if you don't consume any political media that is local, that you're making a terrible mistake in which of your political identities you're strengthening, that we've become too, our national political identities have become way too strong. And our local political identities have weakened, have withered. And that's often because we don't consume media that attaches us to local fights, local questions. You know, you read the New York Times living in San Francisco. And so like that's one, like there's an actionable thing you can do there, but you have to work on your own informational ecosystem to attach yourself to things that are local. But it's a much healthier way of experiencing politics, and you can have much more effect on it.
Well, and also the idea that when we start working on local issues, we can move from the conceptual to the practical. And once people get into positions of solving individual problems, a lot of the agitation goes away. So if you and me and two conservatives are sitting down to try to address the pothole problem, and we're $2,000 short, there's going to be a discussion, but it's not going to have to do with the culture wars. You know, it's a very practical thing. And the more we know about it, the more it's going to become very technical and scientific, which then takes all of the kind of bombast out of the thing. And then afterwards, it makes us feel that we've participated in something democratic and communal and positive. I mean, that's, of course, obviously way too simple. But I think if I look at my life and the people I know, I think a lot of the angst and the agitation of the moment has to do with the feeling that their actions don't actually matter all that much, or that they're spending a lot of energy, a lot of emotional energy and neurological energy in discussions that somehow should be about important things. And they kind of seem like they are, but they don't lead to anything. You know, when I was covering those Trump rallies, there was so much talk about immigration. And so one of the tropes I kept enacting was to talk to a Trump supporter and say, I see that this is immigration is a big issue for you. Can you tell me about when that started for you? And what was the inciting incident with an undocumented person that caused you to have these strong opinions? And it was almost comical that there was never an incident, you know, or if there was, they misunderstood it. There was an accent that was, you know, mistaken as proof of undocumented status. So it was really made dramatically clear to me that this agitation about immigration was largely a projection that flourished in the absence of experience. And again, this might take us back to fiction. You know, fiction is a great discipline of saying, you know, you can't, if you start a story, a bunch of people were somewhere, that story's not going anywhere. But if you say there were four Presbyterians and a bomb cellar, suddenly there's something, you know, and it's all because the story has been grounded in a particular place with particular people under certain conditions. And the wisdom or the knowledge or the understanding that's going to come out of that situation is directly related to how specifically it's been enumerated.
I think it's a wonderful bridge to the final section here, where I'm going to ask you for some fiction among other book recommendations. And so let me begin with this one. What book have you reread the most times?
I think it was probably Red Cavalry by the Russian writer Isaac Babel. It was a book of short stories that's really insane, about when the Russians invaded Poland after the revolution. And it's just a kind of, even in translation, just a stylistic masterpiece. And so when I was young, it really was a touchstone for me of what an intense short story would look like. And then also I go back to Gogol's Dead Souls a lot, just because I love it so much and I have never been able to figure out why. It feels to me like a book that really gets the feeling of being alive right, but I've never been, you know, quite able to put my finger on why. So I just drop into that every now and then just to remind myself.
What book do you give to others most often?
I don't give books that often because I always feel a little bit, you know, like it's sort of imposing. But I did give out Stamped from the Beginning by Ibram X. Kendi quite a few times. For me, it was a life changer for me. And I think it's that book is a great book and kind of a great act of generosity and insight. So I have given that one out a few times.
That really is a great book. What's your favorite work of nonfiction?
I really love Dispatches by Michael Hare, which is the great Vietnam work. He was a friend of ours, and the book is so beautifully open to different mind states. You know, he's in Vietnam, and sometimes he's sort of celebrating it, and sometimes he's horrified. And he's got this amazing prose style that just lets him get into so many, you know, really cool places. And then Michael, actually, when I was writing Lincoln and the Bardo, he recommended this book called Patriotic Gore by Edmund Wilson, which is a series of sketches of the literary lights of the 19th century, most of whom we've never heard of. And it's a really beautiful evocation of a world that was totally as real as ours that has vanished. You know, we don't know these people. It's really, really hard to recreate their mindsets. And of course, they were very passionate about it. And they, you know, people wrote 30, 40 novels. And so for me, it was kind of a great book that just to sort of say, oh yeah, this cultural moment that we're in is sort of a beautiful illusion. You know, it seems real to us. You and I could talk for hours about different cultural references. And in another 100 years, it'll all seem kind of like beautiful nonsense.
What's your favorite work on Buddhism?
Oh, there's so many. I mean, the one I read most recently that I really loved, and I loved it because it did that work of kind of jolting me to attention, was a book by Mingyur Rinpoche called In Love with the World. And it starts out just with kind of a narrative description of a sort of pilgrimage he made. And he so skillfully works in all the kind of basic ideas about Buddhism that and does it in a way that makes them seem really alive and really urgent.
What's a book you go back to for just the sheer beauty of the writing that inspires you as a writer?
Well, there's a British writer named Henry Green that I think people don't read quite as much anymore, but he had a series of short novels, all with one-word titles like Loving, Living, Party Going, Concluding. And I'll just drop into him because I don't know anybody who writes more beautiful sentences in English, just more sculpted and deliberate and purposeful. So it's almost like drinking a little bit of sort of a potion to make you love language again, just because he's taken so much care with it. And also there's some of these big scenes in Huck Finn, like the scene where the guy talks the mob down from a lynching, and some of those big sort of, I think of them as aerial scenes that I've been reading, just because I tend to get a little bit obsessive over sentences, which I think is a good quality, as, you know, with Henry Green. But also I'm a little worried as, you know, I get older, that lapidary quality can sometimes cause you to forfeit the big picture, you know, the kind of thrilling summaries and the bird's eye view. So Twain is such a natural writer. It sounds just like conversation, but when you actually start looking at it or copying it out, it's really incredibly high-level English prose.
What book of poetry would you recommend to somebody who doesn't often read poetry?
Well, I think these are going to be Syracuse writers, but one of our teachers was named Hayden Carruth, and he has a beautiful book called Scrambled Eggs and Whiskey. Just a real, real accessible, emotional, funny poems. And then I think I would also recommend the work of two of my colleagues. Mary Carr has a lovely book called Tropic of Squalor. And then Brooks Haxton has one called They Lift Their Wings to Cry. So what I'm always looking for is sort of like, like with what we saw with Amanda Gorman the other day, that the quality that the poetry is talking to me directly. It's talking to my experience. And the poetic qualities of it are not for show. They're there to communicate higher level things more efficiently.
And I'll end on this one, which is, I mentioned earlier, I have a 2-year-old. I know you've written a wonderful children's book. Are there any children's books you love or that you would recommend that I read to my son?
Have you read The 100 Dresses?
No.
Well, you talk about empathy. You know, it's I won't spoil it, but it's a great story. It's a great short story, actually, about a little girl who's perceived one way, and then we find out that it was very different, actually, behind the scenes. I used to love this book with our kids called Caps for Sale. Real simple little book about this guy who's just, for some reason, outselling caps. He's got a big pile of like 200 caps on his head. And it's just really playful and goofy and kind of poetic. And anything by Seuss. I love Dr. Seuss.
It is really true that children's books, they take a delight in language. It is often lost in adult literature. And it's actually been one of the really fun things about parenthood is just rediscovering some of that baseline delight.
Yeah, or when you find a kid's book that doesn't take that delight and it's a torment.
Yeah, that is very true. Your book is A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, in which four Russians give a masterclass on writing, reading, and life. George Saunders, it's been such a pleasure to get to spend this time with you. Thank you.
A total pleasure for me too, Ezra. Thank you for what you do.
The Ezra Klein Show is a production of New York Times Opinion. It is produced by Roger Karma and Jeff Geld, fact-checked by Michelle Harris, original music by Isaac Jones, and the mixing is by Jeff Geld.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.